Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Stocks are at record highs. Banks are making boatloads of money. What could possibly go wrong? Well, for starters, how about bank earnings that aren't all they seem? How about that? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Wednesday, the 15th of January. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. It is big banking's turn in the barrel this week, earnings-wise. Bank of America beat expectations with its report today, $3.4 billion last quarter. Thank you very much. The other day, it was Wells Fargo announcing record profits. And J.P. Morgan, despite all of its troubles, had a better-than-expected bottom line as well. But as Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports, all of those numbers deserve a closer look.
Yep. The top line, the takeaway here is positive. Banks' balance sheets are improving. Ken Caro is a finance professor at Indiana University's Kelly School of Business.
You can tell that the banking industry is recovering and our economy is on a recovering path.
Whew. If only I could end there. But not so lucky. Turns out these banking numbers maybe smell a little sweeter than they really are. The effects of the housing crisis linger. Banks are writing fewer mortgages. They're facing lawsuits, government settlements. One thing propping up these earnings reports, a little accounting. Big banks are adding billions of dollars from reserves they'd set aside for loan losses that never came to be. Ann Beatty is an accounting professor at Ohio State University.
Now they're reducing their reserve for the bad loans, and that means that they're going to have a positive income effect.
But to be very clear,
there is no cash flow related to this income that's being recorded. It is a pure accounting effect.
So what's a regular investor to do? Fight back with some math of your own.
You do some accounting. It's not easy to do, and you have to look carefully at the financial statements.
David Stoll is a finance professor at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. He says there's a lot of accounting noise in these earnings reports, obscuring the actual business of banking. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Courtesy of the New York Times today, we got another glimpse of what the National Security Agency is doing behind the curtain and how it's doing it. In this case, coming up with nifty ways to use radio transmissions to track about 100,000 personal computers that would be otherwise unavailable. David Sanger at the Times reported the story with Tom Shanker. David, it's good to have you on.
Great to be with you, Kai.
First of all, how is this happening? What's the methodology? How are they doing it?
Kai, what the problem that the NSA has to solve is there is a good subset of computers that are walled off from the internet, completely isolated. And those are usually the computers that the NSA wants to get into most. So they started working more than 5 years ago on a program called the ANT program that devised small radio frequency transceivers that could either be installed in a computer by a human being, maybe when the computer is being shipped, or puts the same transceiver technology on a little thumb drive. And when you plug that in, it can broadcast anything that's going through that computer up to 8 miles away and allow the NSA to attack the computer from the same distance.
What do they do once they have this capability inside the box?
Well, the first thing they can do is plain old surveillance. They're inside your computer at that point. Many of these implants can also be a pathway in to attacking a computer. And remember, we think some of these techniques were used in the most famous cyber attack of all, which was the Stuxnet attack on the Iranian nuclear enrichment site at Natanz.
Along with the usual list of suspects that the NSA is targeting, you say, the Saudis and the Pakistanis and the Russians, trade institutions within the European Union as well. So they're it's friend and foe alike.
It is. And, you know, we learned that during the brouhaha a few months ago about the tapping of Angela Merkel's cell phone. This also gets to the great tension that is growing now between the business community, especially in Silicon Valley, and the NSA, because the business community is increasingly concerned that the techniques that the NSA has used allows the Europeans, the Chinese, others, an excuse not to buy American products. And I think as the year goes on, you're going to see more and more pressure from Silicon Valley to both trim back some of these programs and efforts by Silicon Valley to design systems that the NSA can't penetrate.
About the Chinese, David, the Chinese, as we all know, view national security and economic prowess very closely. How is this tied to that? Are we targeting, if you will, that part of our relationship with the Chinese?
The U.S. says it doesn't conduct any surveillance to steal intellectual property. And I believe that's probably true. If they had it, they wouldn't even know which American company to give it to. The Chinese know who they're going to give it to. Yeah. They're going to give it to their state-owned firms, right? And as you suggest, to the Chinese, stealing intellectual property and commercial secrets is part of their definition of national security. And this is why this whole argument back and forth about surveillance the Chinese do on us or we do on them has sort of been a dialogue of the deaf. We're not using each other's definitions.
David Sanger is the national security correspondent for the New York Times. David, thanks very much.
Thank you, Kai.
The president's big NSA speech, by the way, on topics such as David and I were just talking about, or perhaps not, who knows, is Friday. Until then, the markets are going to have to do you. As I said, records all over the place on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Let's pause for a moment to observe that the 2014 congressional elections are still more than 9 months away. Should you happen to live in a state, however, where the race for a Senate seat is going to be close, say Louisiana or North Carolina, Election Day might feel a whole lot closer. Political advocacy groups are pouring millions of dollars into those races, running ads early, really early, and running them counter to conventional wisdom that it's a better investment to air those ads closer to Election Day. Marketplace's David Gura has the story.
Citizens United and super PACs changed things. Whit Ayers is a Republican political consultant.
I'm not sure there is conventional wisdom anymore.
And that's thanks, in part, to outside spending. It used to be groups wouldn't spend a dollar now because they were worried about running out later. Well, nowadays, there are many more dollars, and that has changed the economics of campaigning.
This is a whole new world of politics where there is certainly no cookbook on how to do things right.
Ayers says conservatives see an opportunity to make the Affordable Care Act the defining issue of 2014.
It makes a lot of sense, from my perspective, to strike while the iron is hot.
And that is what an organization called Americans for Prosperity, backed by the Koch brothers, is doing. Tim Phillips is the group's president. I reached him in Montana, where he just announced a $1.8 million ad buy.
We're determined to make Obamacare front and center the number one issue for the American people.
Phillips says so far his group's strategy has been to use politicians' words against them.
They told us the lie of the year.
If you like your health care plan, we'll be able to keep your health care plan.
And Congressman Bruce Braley kept telling it.
The ads like that one are running in a handful of states. So far, Phillips says Americans for Prosperity has spent $22 million.
And we expect to spend substantially more than that in coming months.
Steve Jarding managed Democratic Senate campaigns before he became a professor at Harvard. He says Democrats are in a tough spot.
They could spend early money to try to compete with this and actually run out of money late.
That's not something Republicans have to worry about. Jarding says before long, we'll be inundated by ads.
Pretty soon, you have ads going essentially year-round, year after year.
And that is what groups like Americans for Prosperity want. Its president says the organization will keep at it after the election is over. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
If you have kids or nieces and nephews, you're probably acquainted somehow with Nickelodeon television. And not just Nickelodeon, but Nicktoons, Teen Nick, Nick Jr. for the preschoolers out there. Soon, you'll be able to add My Nick Jr. to that roster. It's an interactive channel that'll let parents customize their kids' viewing experience, just what we need. And as Kate Davidson reports, it might just be the future of pay TV.
Maybe you love Dora the Explorer.
Dora, Dora, Dora the Explorer! Dora!
Or maybe it drives you batty. With My Nick Jr., you can program your kids' TV channel to only play certain Nick Jr. shows, or shows about certain themes, like problem-solving or friendship. Bill Kula is with Verizon, whose Fios TV will roll out the new cable channel.
After each episode, the child would be asked to rate the show, and if no action were taken, then the next episode would begin.
It's pretty much a direct response to the way streaming services like Netflix and Amazon are changing media consumption. Paul Sweeney of Bloomberg Industries says people are getting used to viewing programming.
When they want to watch it, where they want to watch it, and on whatever device they want to watch, no longer are consumers content to simply watch programming as scheduled by an existing network.
Brad Adgate of Horizon Media says customized channels like My Nick Jr. are the wave of the future. But he has a warning.
Not only can this endeavor hurt rivals like Disney, who's probably their biggest rival in Cartoon Network, but it's also something that could cannibalize Nickelodeon themselves.
He says little kiddos might abandon old Nickelodeon channels for the interactive and now ad-free My Nick Jr. That could hurt ratings and decrease advertising revenue for the old-school channels of the Nickelodeon family. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
Bank earnings, as Ms. Hill was telling us up at the top of the broadcast, are doing fine. In fact, corporate profits as a rule are doing all right. There's lots of money to be made out there on both sides of the law, as it turns out. And as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler is about to tell us, there really can be such a thing as too much money.
Drug cartels in Mexico have a money problem. They have more cash than they know what to do with, literally. If you bring a lot of cash to a bank like this one in Mexico City, the teller will say,
"We need the invoice or receipt that shows why you are making the deposit in cash."
It's harder to deposit cash because of new Mexican banking laws, so cartels end up warehousing mountains of it in various stash houses. When Mexican police confiscated the loot from a cartel associate, U.S. agent Jerry Miles got closer than most of us ever will to $200 million in cash.
Wall to wall, 3 feet high, to within like a foot to 2 feet of the entryway to the room. They're just stacks of money.
To keep those walls of cash from being confiscated by police, the cartels need a way to legitimize their drug money and show that their revenues were made legally. It's called money laundering, and the cartels do a lot of it here in the U.S. Jerry Miles is a federal agent with Homeland Security Investigations.
We're seeing money come back into the United States as part of the scheme to launder money.
I met Jerry Miles across from a church in downtown Los Angeles. He focuses on what's known as trade-based money laundering. In other words, buying and selling consumer goods to disguise the criminal origins of the money. Imagine the cartel buys a shipment of widgets worth $100,000 in the U.S. But on the Mexican customs form, the cartels lie and say that they paid $200,000.
They take the $100,000 where they really sold the widgets. Then they take another $100,000 of their own money, the dirty money, they go to the bank and say, "See, I sold all these widgets for $200,000, here's $200,000. It's a lot more complicated than that, but that is like the basic concept of it.
It's those discrepancies in the paper trail that often trip up the criminals. Special Agent Hector Colon investigates the cartels as if he were going after white-collar criminals.
We've always believed that cartels operate as if they were a corporation.
Cologne says cartels employ their own kind of chief financial officer, the criminal kind.
They will open corporations or they will seek businesses that are willing to move money for cartels.
Right now, Cologne is analyzing international trade data for gold.
What I'm noticing in this graph is that the value of gold bullion down here is being declared well below the value of scrap gold. And we know that gold bullion is more pure than scrap gold.
That's one way law enforcement identifies money launderers, but how easily can merchants spot them? I'm here in the Los Angeles Jewelry District. I'm looking for merchants who've been approached by people working for the cartels who are trying to launder money. I spent a couple days cold calling jewelers. Several told me that they frequently get propositions about large cash deals that would be off the books, but they were afraid to talk on the radio. But it has to be tempting for the retail jewelers I met on the ground floor. For them, business is bad. You can see how desperate retailers might start rationalizing bags of questionable cash. And it's not just the gold and jewelry businesses. The cartels are diversified. In the past, they've invested in products ranging from kids' toys to plasma TVs. Again, Agent Jerry Miles.
We believe this is going to become a bigger problem in the near to midterm future.
Homeland Security Investigations predicts there will be significant arrests related to trade-based money laundering in the coming months. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Coming up, turning housing on its head.
It's certainly a bet. Whether it's worth making, we'll know in a couple years how it turns out. But this seems like a low-cost bet. Let's put it that way.
To rent or not to rent. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials jumped another 108 points this Wednesday, two-thirds of 1%, closed at 16,481. The NASDAQ up 31 points, three-quarters percent, ended at 4,214. The S&P 500 lifted 9 points, about a half percent, wrapped things up at 1848. Financials helped lead the day. Bank of America put on 2.25% on strong earnings that Ms. Hill was telling us about. Adrian, by the way, is her name. J.P. Morgan Chase raked in 3%. Wells Fargo and Citigroup each gained close to 2% today. Apple shined up 2% on news that China Mobile already has 1 million pre-orders for the iPhone as part of a new partnership those two companies had. Microsoft added 2.75%. Solar City, the nation's largest installer of solar panels, beamed up 4.5% today. Bond prices down. The yield on the 10-year T-note up 2.89%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. On Capitol Hill, the Joint Economic Committee is scheduled to discuss income inequality in the United States. The annual Sundance Film Festival gets under its glitzy way in Park City, Utah. And usually here, I'd identify some special day for you to observe. But in its place, tomorrow is National Nothing Day, an unevent. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. For decades and decades, the through line of the American dream has been, why rent when you can buy? And so just about 65% of the people in this country own their own homes. On this side of the Great Recession, though, plowing your life savings into a questionable asset is a different proposition. So companies are making bets that more and more Americans are going to want to rent instead of buy. One of the biggest bettors is a company called Invitation Homes. They've been buying foreclosed properties by the thousands and renting them out. But it's still not clear what kind of landlord Invitation is going to be. From Minnesota Public Radio, Annie Baxter has that story.
Last spring, this real estate agent named Jim Tice was trying to sell a client's house in a Minneapolis suburb. The home was headed to foreclosure. Then the client got a cash offer from a firm that Tice had never heard of. He says the company showed him a bank statement. It wanted to prove it had enough cash to cover the deal. And yeah, they had enough. Like millions.
Buyer usually isn't showing you millions of dollars of savings in order to buy. So it was pretty impressive in that respect.
The company is Invitation Homes. It's a subsidiary of the Blackstone Group, which just so happens to be the world's largest private equity firm. Over the past year and a half, Invitation Homes has snapped up 40,000 houses in key markets. That cost a hefty $7.5 billion. Invitation Homes largely buys low-priced foreclosures. Then it spiffs them up and rents them out. Experts say large-scale purchases of foreclosures by investors like Invitation Homes have helped housing markets heal.
Had it not been for them, the prices would have fallen further and it would have taken longer to recover.
Elliot Eisenberg is a housing economist. He says since the foreclosure crisis, credit standards have tightened and a lot of people can't get a mortgage. As a result, Invitation Homes and other big investors are betting that home rentals will become increasingly popular.
It's certainly a bet. Whether it's worth making, we'll know in a couple years how it turns out. But this seems like a low-cost bet. Let's put it that way.
Until recently, it's largely been mom-and-pop outfits that rent houses. Eisenberg says big investors could potentially run that business more professionally. So far, Michael Apple has had a good experience renting a 4-bedroom house from Invitation Homes in a Minneapolis suburb. Apple says if something's broken, his property manager jumps right on it.
Either I call her or I email her, and she gets back to me within a day or so.
Not so for another Twin Cities renter, Brad Dukes. He's got a beef about the throne in his rental home. When Duke sits on the toilet, his knees barely clear the wall in front of him.
This is going to sound odd, but could you sit on the toilet
so I
can see how close?
Yeah, here you go. How about this? That's super awesome, wouldn't you say?
Duke says the house was advertised as having 2 bathrooms, but one was just a freestanding toilet in the basement. Invitation Homes agreed to frame up a real bathroom and dropped a few grand to add walls, a shower, and a sink.
Do they have plans to do something to this drywall?
Oh, they are finished. So the
this is how it's going to look.
Oh, yeah. The exterior of this box they put in this unfinished room is going to remain. Yeah, I'm going to be looking at sheetrock.
Renters and other markets have panned Invitation Homes in online reviews. But in the Twin Cities, at least, the company may not have enough renters yet to establish a clear track record. I checked out a random sample of homes the company's purchased. All of them were vacant, some for more than half a year. All right, I'm peering through the windows now at a 7th property in Minneapolis. This is empty, too. Andrew Galina is a spokesman for Invitation Homes. He's aware of the empty houses and complaints from renters. Galina admits the company is still learning the ropes. It has, after all, purchased 40,000 homes in a short period of time.
There are times when we're going to be disappointing to a resident, but I think at the same time, we have a real commitment to getting it right.
Of course, if the landlord gig doesn't work out, the firm always has an exit strategy. Sell the homes at a profit as prices rise. In St. Paul, Minnesota, I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
You're in the kitchen making dinner. You go to the drawer, you pull out a knife, you notice it's a bit dull, so you run it through that knife sharpener thing you have in that same drawer. Happens all the time, right? In Spain, it doesn't quite work that way. The job of knife sharpener is a tradition over there. Somebody arrives at your doorstep, your home or your business, usually on a motorcycle, and hand sharpens your knives. But that tradition and the job is slowly disappearing, as the BBC's Tom Burridge reports from Seville.
You might just be able to make out what is an unmistakable sound in Spain. For people here in this neighbourhood in the southern beautiful Spanish city of Seville, it means just one thing. It's knife sharpening time.
53-year-old Rafael Romero del Campo has been sharpening knives in Seville since he was 13.
I have 5 children and 4 grandchildren. And my job as a knife sharpener feeds them all.
Do you like your job?
The truth is there's no other work. I've been doing it for so many years that I love it.
There goes the engine. Wheel rotates at speed. And then Rafael moves each knife to and fro across the wheel. And in a matter of minutes, you won't find a sharper knife in Seville. It's 9:30 in the morning and we've come to the Bodegon Sierra, which is as typical a Spanish cafe as you can find. Workers are in here before they start their day glugging down milky coffee. This is a really poor working class neighbourhood. And outside is Rafael's motorbike. These local businesses pay Rafael's wage. Miguel travels around Seville on his motorbike. But when he started, when he was 13, he spent 3 years travelling around on a bicycle, and he used the bicycle to sharpen knives.
Rafael's whistle warns potential customers he's in town.
We're in another neighbourhood now, outside the fishmonger of Miguel Paredes.
Miguel talks us through a selection of his fresh fish, before proudly showing us his fish knife in action. And yes, the knife makes the fish look like butter.
Everywhere we go with Rafael, people greet him and shake his hand. Because of his job, he's known across Seville.
And if this traditional way of collecting and sharpening knives were to disappear, then a small part of Spanish society and culture would be lost.
How many more years are you going to keep working as a knife sharpener here in Seville?
Para mí, toda la vida.
All my life, I'll never stop until I go to another world.
And when Raphael's gone, a sound and a trade will disappear from these streets too.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, in which I am not, repeat, not quitting my job. I got in a whole mess of trouble the last time I joked about that, so we don't really talk about that around here much anymore at all. But if I were to be quitting, boy, have I found a good way to do it. It's called Quit Your Job app. You decide why you want to quit. It sends an appropriate or inappropriate text to your boss. Also available from the same company, by the way, and I am not making this up, the Breakup Text app. Y'all can figure out what that one is, right? All right, that is Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow up 108 points, two-thirds of 1%. The NASDAQ up 31 points, three-quarters percent. The S&P 500 lifted 9 points. That is a half percent. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Brendan Willard, and Randy Wine engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll meet you back here tomorrow, everybody. I love my job. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.